America. He's talking about a moon.
Middle America.
Okay. Sounds like imitating Bob Dobbs. Stang's Bob. That's what you're getting at, aren't you?
No. It's kind of like... Is it... Do you think being in Las Vegas influences it?
No.
No?
Advertising?
Advertising.
It's advertising.
There's an... Well, that's part of the Church of Slack.
It's like put on dramatic. It's almost like...
Ah, oh, he's hot. He's got a cool ground for a hot style. That's what I mean by ironic.
I'd say that he's got a real cool...
Which is an 80s... That's neo-tech. That's high-tech, but then on human scale. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? In other words, he's miming the mood of the 80s, which has a cool ground, but a hot media, high-tech spiral. So we're the hard sell. But he has an ironic, cool basis for it. So therefore, yeah, he would sound a bit like a hard sell, but with a sense of humor about it.
I think they take themselves very seriously, actually.
Well, that's part of the hard sell. Yeah. Mike, are we okay? Anybody fall asleep yet?
No.
Oh, another aspect of advertising is the blood of the mixed media interplay. The figures for advertising are, of course, the poltergeist, the polls. And the polls study the audiences of each medium. But each medium isn't studying us. It is studying the audiences of other media. Therefore, they consume and subsume and interpenetrate, interplay with each other. So poltergeist is the language, the hidden ground of the effects of one medium polling the other medium. So you see, we're left outside of that situation, right? So you might as well say, on the biological people level, we're dead. But we're hooked up by the electric environment, which makes us super angels. So we go around that interplay. So we, like the astronaut, look at the planet. It's just that the image of the planet, kind of the size of a basketball versus the astronaut in the 60s, now the astronaut is like on the planet. That's where human scale has ballooned and inflated.
He's disincarnate, looking at himself on the planet.
Yeah, with the opposite image of being back on the planet again.
Right.
Now that's a complex image, but yeah.
Right.
So the astronaut is walking around on the planet, yet he's supposed to be on Mars. So that's what we are. So we study the language of the poltergeist, and then the effects of that in advertising. Mike, we had a call.
No.
No. Okay. 595-1478. If Sean wanted to call back.
Actually, okay, I have another thing. I was listening to Bob Marshall.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine is into Seth.
Yeah.
Jane Roberts, all that. I was wondering if there's any. It seems to me somewhat of a. She looks like a pretty demonic kind of person. I don't know. But excuse me. She may be a very nice lady, but that's what I feel. And the Church of Seth is a, or the Temple of Seth, the Temple of Seth.
Oh, the Temple of Set?
Seth, I think.
It was Set. Yeah, Seth. Dave Emery.
Oh, is there any connection with those two? No?
No. The Temple of Set, or Seth, that's a good point. I have to ask Bob about that. That is the... church that took over from Anton LaVey's Church of Satan in San Francisco. And Aquino, the member of military intelligence in the States, was caught with a child abuse scandal. And so that Temple of Set is the satanic church that is under the focus of Dave Emery on Bob Marshall's show. But no, Seth is not Set.
No.
Now, Seth, though, is a biblical figure. And has a bit of a negative connotation. So maybe that's why Jane looks negative to you, demonic. Seth wasn't a particular happy child in the Bible. So Seth may be a variation of Set.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
All right, Mike, there's something. Unless Tiger wants to say something. No. She's meditating.
We do have a call, Bob. Would you like to take the caller first?
Yeah, I would like to take a call.
Okay.
Andrew was important, but we got to flip.
Okay, hi, Sikhelen.
Oh, Bob?
Yeah.
Yes, that was the evil serpent god in the Conan mythology.
Thanks, Dub.
Just figured you
out. And who was that. Seth?
Pardon?
Who was Seth? Wasn't that in the Bible?
Oh, yes, Seth. S-E-T-H.
Yeah, that was one of the brothers or something?
He was somebody's father or brother or cousin or uncle.
And did some negative stuff.
Or son, I don't know.
All right, so Seth is a biblical figure around Noah or one of those guys, right?
And I think he was good, you know, because Seth was a commonly given name on the American frontier, and those people read their Bibles and took it pretty seriously.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I can't say, like, if you were, like, a really bad guy, you know, they didn't call their kids after bad guys.
But then the ground was different then. They might have thought a bad guy was a good guy 300 years ago.
Well, if he smote high and low
yeah.
with his fiery brand or something like that, we might call him bad today, but I doubt it.
All right, so Set is, could you say again what that is?
The evil serpent god in Conan mythology by Robert E. Howard, the Texan.
Right, but what, isn't Set from Egyptian mythology?
Yeah, that's accurate for the word. That's probably where Howard got it. His concept of space was unbelievable. He actually wrote it up, and he claimed that his mythological planet Earth had nothing to do with mythology whatsoever. He invented it completely out of his mind, but every fragment of it is drawn from ancient Greek, Roman, British history books.
Okay, listen, Dub, we haven't talked to you in 3 weeks. You do a lot of monitoring of advertising yourself. What idea you got to offer us or percept tonight?
Some poet wrote advertisements for myself. Was that Irving Layton?
Advertisements for myself was Norman Mailer.
No, Norman Mailer. That's right. You got it.
That was in the 50s.
Yeah, so that came into my mind.
It would be interesting to check out when he wrote that, because he had a crisis when he appeared on a televised talk show in the early 50s, in the middle 50s, let's say. And he really felt the effects of being discarnate in a negative way. He didn't understand why what he was trying to sell and talk about with a literate bias, having a point of view, he felt instinctively didn't come across on the television medium. And so I'd be curious, the scholar would check that out. Did he write advertisements for myself after the discarnate effect he had on that early televised talk show? That would be interesting to check out.
I would say so, because it's contemporary with late Beat, Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, yeah.
Publication of Allen Ginsberg, which would have been after he wrote it.
I want to present something to you, Dub.
Yeah.
Since the mixed media corporate version are the actors and archetypes, then what we call the artist, the entertainment figure, would have to be an appendage of those effects. So,
an appendage of the effects
of the media actors.
No, that's going down into death. That's the dance of all the creatures devolving into an extremely degenerate form.
And yeah, that's where we're at.
It could only happen, you got to pick some poetic phrases for this, but the entropy is supposed to be the heat death of the universe, so you think it's like getting your brains cooked, but it's not. It's when the temperature goes everywhere and everything gets equally cold.
All right, the temperature is a good media, a good metaphor, because that's hot and cool. But let me just tell you what to follow up. I agree with what you said so far. It's just that if mixed media effects are the corporate actors in the global solar theater...
Corporate actors now.
No, actors on the global theater,
right.
Now a solar theater. But the prominent artists would mix and mime the subtleties and nuances between the interplay of these media. For example, here's what I propose. This is an update of what I said about a year ago, but I would say that you take the figure of Frank Zappa and why he's a holy office. As an artist, in the specialist form of artist, he sculptures kinetic and acoustic space effects via visual space bias. Now, I point that out to show that to talk about a modern artist today, with artists that have a survival ability and stay in for the long haul, that they would mime the effect of the corporate actors in their own personal work. Therefore, they would have to have mixed media and be proficient in a charismatic way in various media. So,
okay,
you see what I'm saying there?
You can't have charisma without effective involvement with mixed media. That's a given at any level. That would be true in the Stone Age. It would be it would be true in a unknowable future, right?
Yeah.
But Frank Zappa is identified as being a principal actor, and he works with the material around him as a protean mix, and he shapes it and forms it.
Sculptures. Now, sculpture is tactile. That's the old form of tactility.
But in a very fresh and continuous way.
Yeah, he takes kinetic space, which is the American and movie radio environment, mixes it with the acoustic space effects of music and radio, but he has a visual space bias. He's kind of a retrieval of the 18th century in his constitutional fundamentalism. He's very prominent and outspoken on basic American constitutional issues. That's visual space. That's the 18th century. And also his kind of detachment and tribally being opposed to being tribal.
He's conservative.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, that makes sense because, he's not an appendage of the message.
He's an appendage of the computer. The computer is figure and satellite is ground because the computer creates a electric autonomous independent visual bias. And he said that if he had the Sync Clavier, which he's working with now, that he wouldn't have gone on the road in the 60s if he had that. So he is expressing a kind of...
What's the Sync Clavier?
That's a computerized musical...
device?
Yeah. What would you say, Mike? Computerized synthesizer, incredible mixed media in the studio format.
I think he may say that, but he would have gone on the road because... if the artist is an appendage of something, he's either an appendage of the past or an appendage of the future. And I think because we look forward and our gaze goes forward and our mind and spirit goes forward and that's irretrievable, that in fact every human being must be an appendage of the future, can't be an appendage of the past. Because if you look upon it as a tornado, which is seen as a cone which tapers towards the center, which is above the ground, gets very narrow, then widens again, you see?
Yeah.
You've got a vortex. You've got a narrowing from the past to the present momentary event, and then narrowing to that point from the past and widening into the future. And moment of creation, properly so-called, when the egg is fertilized, so on and so forth, does its work under the most elementary chemical signals, a little bit of electricity, a little bit of gravity is all it needs. And but it immediately takes out of itself, doubles itself, and puts a new shiny slime around itself, a good slime. And there you have newness. So it's like a water droplet dropping off a stalagmite or stalactite, whichever is the correct term. In the moment that it parts company, it's not connected to the previous funnel at all. But in the sense that it can look, it can only look into the future. It's the only place that spirit can go. But the stuff of us is somehow brought from the past. So when we meditate on our own internal state, we're meditating, in a sense, in company with the past, wouldn't you think?
Yep.
So, now, how we could be meditating in company with the future is interesting, because if you consider people talk about reincarnation and they talk about various types of telepathy, or they wonder about these things, and I really think that all of that is really more concerned with the past than the future, that the future is... The future is utterly demanding, you know. It's not really to be toyed with at all, you see?
Yeah.
Because it has that imminent power. When you touch it, something happens. And Frank Zappa, a protean artist, right? He has to be a principal actor, but he's an appendage of the future. And in seeing this aspect of Frank, then we see the same necessary aspect of each and every one of us, that we all necessarily share in that relation, and it's where we're going, you know, and that's good, I think.
Okay, well, if you think of the kinetic environment as movie and car, The acoustic is radio and speech. The visual is book, photo, newspaper, geometry and the computer, and tactile is television. Let's try Burroughs. Burroughs visualizes kinetic and acoustic and old tactile space effects.
The old pieces of newspaper cut up and glued together and pasted on a page. He's that kind of a writer, right?
That's the visualizing of the American and radio and cultish and extrasensory ESP group, which I'd call the old tactile, not the new electric tactile. So we would agree that he visualizes kinetic and acoustic and old tactile space effects, right?
I think I don't want to criticize Burroughs because I'm not sure that I understand him completely, right?
Yeah, note that I don't say sculptures. He visualizes because he uses print media. Now, you take Beefheart, Captain Beefheart. He's a sculptor. He's tactile, but he sculptures visual and acoustic space, poetry and music, all right, via old tactile space bias, the Paleolithic ESP, pre-agrarian, pre-civilized modality, all right?
Paleolithic, that's good. Did you hear about the dinosaur footprints?
In the tombs?
In the mines out west. Apparently, back, 100 million years ago, whenever the dinosaurs were around, the really big ones walked around and left really major footprints. And these things filled up with, you know, organic matter and bog and whatnot. And then, somehow later on, they became like what happens to fossils. Water goes through and deposits its minerals as it either passes on and then something becomes fossilized, so the mud and detritus that accumulated in the dinosaur footprint becomes a great big fossil chunk, about 5 foot by 4 foot or whatever. And then these guys are doing mining out in the American West, and they get underneath these damn things, and the roof of the mine falls in on them, you see?
Mm.
So that they're said to have been killed by the accidental stuff of a dinosaur.
That's the future. That's the dinosaur's future.
This has happened to human beings in this century.
Is that recent?
This is what I'm given to understand. Now,
I mean, like you hear this week or 2 years ago?
No, last 60 days.
Ah.
Maybe 90 days.
Well, that's a good juxtaposition to what I said. Now, I'm going to go on to another character. I'm leading up to McLuhan, but you know a little bit about LaRouche. You would take LaRouche, he sculptures because he's political. Kinetic and visual space, the American environment, and book and geometry effects via acoustic space bias. Now, acoustic space is more like a radio image, part of that hot media spiral retrieval that Reagan was. And acoustic also is the conceptual bias of his trying to articulate process in geometry, in geometric form. You may not be aware of his particular work, but via going from there, unless you want to comment on the roof. But I then would say the supreme artist would be McLuhan, because he sculptures kinetic, acoustic, and visual space effects via tactile space bias. In other words, he's the one more of the appendage of television.
No, I think McLuhan sculpted history, if you want the off-the-top.
Yeah, but the technical grounds of history.
Well, he may have pointed to the future, okay? But I don't quite think that he sculpted the imminent future the way Frank Zappa did. I think that it's more like what I said about past is historical, you see?
Right. No, this is how I relate to what you just said. Zappa points to the future, in your sense, because the future is a visual space goal-oriented bias. So Zappa has a visual space bias. McLuhan considered history contained in language. So he included all times and spaces. He would not be future-oriented. And he'd be a weather vane pointing both past and future and forward.
Well, see, but the way he explained language was to go through history and point out all the little details, which in a way is like pointing out reference of words. In other words, this is what the word stands for. That's what the word stands for. That's what the word stands for. These are the things that happened.
No. He didn't do it. That's more of a Northrop Frye angle. That's some matching meanings. Marshall How could you say that he presented history as words when you look at his Bible, Finnegan's Wake? What words is in Finnegan's Wake?
But he didn't write that. He read it.
No, that was his roadmap, though. He was, as a critical artist, that's what he was trying to explain, Finnegan's Wake.
Well, let me say this about Joyce. If the Irish have any quality that's little thought upon, but very true, it's that they're extremely sharp critics. And they're extremely critical. And criticism is an end in itself for the Irish mentality. They can take pleasure in that. Now, the thing about Joyce, as I understand it, was his extremely sharp critical faculty. Extremely sharp. He looked around and he almost didn't say anything about lots of things.
Now, this is a good point. See, the Irish sensibility would be more of a hard bias in the interface relationship. Now, it was Conor Cruise O'Brien who protested the German unification. He called it the New Fourth Reich, and so I'd say the Irish sensibility may not be as...
Just recently.
Yeah, he protested it about 2 months ago. He was the loudest voice out of Ireland to protest the imminent...
Well, you know, he's an interesting guy because two things come up.
See, he'd be too hard for the soft interplay that's coming in, the human scale. So the Irish, this could be something to follow in the future, how the Irish deal with this new atmosphere of human scale.
Well, what I wanted to... Conor Cruise O'Brien, now he wrote a history of England and Ireland, which is quite well received, and it's modern and it's brisk. And the one thing that he said in it that leaped out and struck my eye was that the English and the Irish were members of two fundamentally different cultures, that they were profoundly and radically different from each other in a sense of what they'd inherited from the Bronze Age, probably.
Well, McLuhan would say visual space versus the oral space.
Well, Conor Cruise O'Brien, not to put too fine a point on it, said that the English and the Irish looked at each other and their instinctive, the profound distaste they felt for each other's nature, each other's essential nature, overwhelmed everything else, and that this is what wrote finis to any good relation between those two nations. Now, I beg to differ. I'm Irish, and I quite simply don't agree with them. I think that's an extremely harsh judgment, and it betrays a predilection on his part to think in very hard-nosed terms, which are in some ways not very much different from stereotyping, claiming that the past is engraved in stone, this is different than that, and thus it ever shall be. And I don't agree. I think what the Germans need is a good leaving alone, because that's what they've been getting for 30 years, and they flourished and thrived on it. And the prospect today is that the East Germans be allowed to share in that very good social health. And I know there's a lot of nittering going on. I don't want to put Conor Cruise O'Brien down too much, because he's a good man, but
you see, you're Canadian Irish.
Not him.
You're Canadian Irish.
No, I was born there.
No, but you've been living in a Canadian environment for 40 years.
Well, that's right? True, but I have my own deep feelings. See,
so you would have a softer view of the Irish heritage.
Not necessarily. That,
maybe that's not the way to say it. You would be a softer Irish. You wouldn't... Canada's British. You're more used to it.
Well, I might be more ignorant than him, and that's quite possible, but when you're talking about the fundamental nature of events that occurred 700 years ago... I think we all have to share ignorance, you know?
Yeah.
The man's 20, 30 years older than me, maybe smarter, but he's not that much smarter that his opinion on 700 years ago is twice as good as mine. I doubt it. And, you know, you have to look at things. You have to look at more fundamental things. Like, for example, that criticism of Ireland, of his, that I mentioned, it makes superficial sense unless you stop and realize that the Scotch and the Welsh are still very different from the English, that the Basques are still wailing away down there in Spain, you know, claiming not to belong to the modern community at all, and the Belgians and the Dutch still keep careful track of the differences between themselves. And you see, it's not a unique, staggering thing, the difference between the English and the Irish. It's just more of the same old stuff. Like, if you want to have...
And what is that old stuff?
Human stuff.
Yeah.
You know, human stuff. Look at the Germans would always like to explain Germany to anyone who wants to listen, but they don't start trying to explain it unless you get on their case. You know, I think if they get left alone, they do pretty well. The ideas that they went into the Second World War with were outdated ideas from the 19th century, and that's the whole story of the First World War, and well, the Second World War was a horror show, but I don't think it was uniquely German. I just think that they had a very unfortunate role to play, as it eventually turned out.
Oh, okay, Mike, we have another caller. We don't have another call. We can let Dub go on.
I'd like to wrap up anyway, though, Bob.
Oh, is it? Dub, so that's a fine thought from a Canadian Irish. I think the German embassy will give you a phone call.
Yeah, but you should hear some of the dull, dull, dull stuff that's going around about this. I mean, if you leave people alone with this, they'll mess up that German thing. I don't think they're going to get a chance to. But remember, the Germans weren't left alone after the Second World War. The British, the Americans especially, and the French too, just got in there and said, okay, everything's going to be level here. It's going to be a level playing field. And they left it alone. In most of the, you know, in a lot of important ways. Without, I don't want to oversimplify it too much. So, but there was a strong monitor saying, leave it alone. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Now look what's happening today. Canada, excuse me for sounding like that, is complaining because they don't get to sit down and at the table and decide how Germany gets divided up. Well, I don't know what's wrong with this country or what we've come to, that we should feel put out because we don't get to sit down at the table and tell somebody else how to act. I really do think it reflects the utter ignorance of the unexamined policies of the last two or three federal cabinets we've had.
Hey, Dub, I think that would be, if Canada's feeling involved on the hot media level, that's the retrieval of human scale. They're wrapped up in the human scale mood because Canada's a human scale country, all right?
Well,
and so, therefore, we feel the mandate to be on there because the mood of human scale is now dominant.
But, Bob, where is it at, sitting down and telling someone else how to act? What? I mean, that fundamental comes true. The Germans would really prefer not to be told how to act.
Well, that's the bias of tactility, is that we interplay and interrelate with the areas beyond our boundaries. But because we interpenetrate in a discarnate state, we forgot that old premise of Japanese etiquette.
Yeah, but doesn't it seem to you that, remember, it's not all of Canada that has this feeling. It's our foreign office under particular administrations. And doesn't it seem to you that they're confusing the gloss with the substance? They're saying, hey, we want to be allowed to be at the party. It's like they've forgotten.
Well, on top-down control, Canada's a very important position. It's just the Switzerland in the solar government, and it's been Bolshevik control through the 80s. So I think that's why they would want to be involved, because they were involved.
We tell our people, we tell each other, we tell ourselves that we don't believe in power politics. Now, we know that may be a pipe dream. It may not come true in 100 years, but that's our major rap. We don't believe in power politics, right?
Yeah, human scale. We've got a human scale bias here.
So there's a massive contradiction involved.
Yeah.
When a man like Gorbachev comes forward and just about turns the whole idea of power politics upside down, and he just about practically throws it out the window for the rest of the century and maybe half of the next century, if we're lucky. And at that moment, Canada's knocking at the door saying, hey, we want to be allowed to sit at the big table in power politics. Give me a break. It's not a question of whether we got a right to. Of course we do. I mean, 50,000 soldiers went over there and died. We were involved in that war, so we certainly have a right to something. But the question I'm asking is, why do we want it? Isn't there this tremendous fundamental contradiction between the fact that as a nation we're supposed to be 25 million people who don't believe in power politics? Now,
end on that thought.
Bunch of
we're going to end there.
Up there who want to play a different game. We have to ask ourselves, are they thinking in the same ballpark that we're thinking or living in?
I don't think so.
Are they thinking at all? You see?
And that's their problem. They're thinking. They're using concepts, not percepts. But that's jargon, right? So we got to go. Thanks, Doug.
Right.
Thanks.
See you later.
Okay, I've got another call. Let's go to this one caller and we'll call it a night.
Okay. What's the time?
It's 20 minutes after 1.
Oh, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, you're welcome, Bob. Okay, CKLN, Church of the Subgenius Show, and one final call to wrap things up. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Hi, Edward.
Hi, show.
Oh.
One 3 weeks ago was a real extravaganza.
A screamer, wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh, a screamer.
Yeah. Going into the archives being mapped around the world.
Yeah, thanks for taping it.
Oh, yeah, great flavors you're putting in there. Just the Norman Mailer footnote, which kind of rhymes at the beginning of the show. In 1957, he was being interviewed by Mike Wallace, and Wallace said...
Where do you get this back?
From a book, Advertisements for Myself, copyright 1959.
Okay, so the TV show happened in 57?
Yeah.
Ah, good.
And Wallace said, I understand that in a column... Oh, yeah, it was under the chapter, How to Commit Murder in the Mass Media. I think Mailer actually meant suicide here.
Yeah.
So Mailer's talking to Mike Wallace, who's still going strong, and Wallace says, you propose that Ernest Hemingway run for president, saying, this country could stand a man for president, since for all too many years our lives have been guided by the men who are essentially women, which indeed is good for neither men nor women.
The Dagwood syndrome.
Mailer said, that's right, I said that.
Yeah.
And Wallace, were you serious about Mailer? Oh, absolutely. Wallace coming in for the kill. What do you mean by that, men who are essentially women? Who among our leaders is so unmasculine that you regard him in that light? And Mailer, well, I think President Eisenhower is a bit of a woman. When the show ended 5 minutes later, my wife came up to me and whispered, well, we may be dead tomorrow, but it was worth it. And then it wasn't widely noticed. Mailer was surprised. A couple of columnists, a presidential aide requested a transcript. And then the worst part, later on, it was collected in a book called Mike Wallace Interviews. And the picture, Mailer said, was the worst photograph ever taken of him in his life. It was at a public crisis he experienced earlier in 1949. The picture that Mike Wallace used in his interview book showed a young, sweaty, adenoidal young man in a desperate need of a haircut. His eyes glitter. His mouth is getting ready to snarl. And he has a mad look in his eyes. He bears an unmistakable resemblance to a cornered rat. Which is quite the opposite feeling of appearing on your show. Or did I appear? Good night.
Well, that's great. That really highlights the themes of the night.
It does, but as soon as I say one more call, there is one more call. And it is important because it is topical to what we've discussed tonight in, at some stages. And
what, this call we just had, or are you saying there's another call?
The call's coming up right now. Hi, CKLM.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, hello. Am I talking to you?
You are. You're on the air.
Oh, I can't hear you on the phone.
That's okay. It doesn't work that way.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Tell them to turn up the radio.
Can you hear the radio?
Yeah, I can hear the radio.
Okay, that's the way to do it.
I have some information on Neotech for you.
Oh, okay.
Just about to call you to ask you about it, and those people turned up.
Slack here at the church, right?
Yep.
I mean, we talk about Mailer, and Eddie comes up with the information.
Yeah. From what I know about it, they have some basic concepts, one of which is biological immortality, is what they want to develop on the planet. And the other is the elimination of mysticism. And so what do you think of that?
That's a secular humanist vision, isn't it?
Well, I don't know.
I think that they are frozen in the old Greek nature. They think their body is the limits of the bag of chemicals we are.
Yeah, it sort of has to do with laissez-faire capitalism, I think, is where they're coming from. But they, one of the things they believe in is the non-use of force against individuals, and they treat the individual human as the prime value of the universe. So.
Oh, okay. So what we got here, the media archetypes use the centennial metaphor. So the metaphor of the 20th century is going to be tactility. So you have them having the bias of the 20th century hoiking up electric autonomy. That's the superhumanizing of the individual you just said. But they're fitting it back into an 18th century bias. The ideal of the enlightened scientist or the enlightened body. the program begun by Francis Bacon.
So
they're mixing the 18th century with the 20th century.
Well, they claim to have 200,000 followers now worldwide.
Well, that's puny.
What?
200,000?
Yeah.
Every object has that much of an audience.
Yeah, 0.01% of the world population.
Yeah. So that's why the electric age is creating incredible diversity, because you can wake up 200,000 people under electric conditions. Since you have access to billions of people, every person can access as a kind of cult art form, cult as art form, have access to a couple thousand, 300,000, whatever.
So why do I find this philosophy so attractive?
Because I don't want to say the truth, but it has perfect pitch. It resonates with your direct experience you have every day.
So why don't you want to...
See, the problem is I just misinterpreted your question. I thought you were talking about me and my philosophy.
Oh, well,
you're talking about neo-tech, aren't you?
Yeah, I am, and it's an attractive philosophy to me, and I like, you know, several concepts of it, which is honesty is one thing, which is attractive, and they have, like, honesty, hard work, biological immortality, and, you know, they go on a non-mystical basis, and so I guess that's attractive.
Okay, I would say that... you are attracted to my philosophy in the deepest subconscious, but on the conscious levels, now the consciousness is now an art form. It's a module you put on. I call it the mythic stage. And you're putting on certain concepts and metaphysical patchwork as a kind of anesthetic, or what Dublin calls the brown bag effect. I would say maybe your astrological sign is resonating with those concepts in the neotech world. What sign are you?
Pisces.
Yeah, you check out the Pisces characteristics, and it either is an anti-environment to the Pisces thing, or it is a rhyming of the Pisces characteristic. So you're putting on your personal preference, which you can under electric autonomous conditions, as a art form.
So what does this mean?
In
language that my conscious mind can understand.
It means that you have the time to put a lot of emotional and intellectual energy into your hobbies. And putting on a certain cult aspect of the neotech values would be a hobby, because you are daily involved in a massive work of making sense. Everybody on the global theater is making sense. And that's a very taxing, demanding activity. No matter what role you play, you are contributing as much as anybody else, including the cancel out factors of you canceling the work or counter work that you're doing, done by someone else. So you see how you would put on a book as a kind of simple drug, or a pamphlet, or an album?
Yeah, I can sort of see what you're saying. Yeah.
I'm just saying that you do not have to become mystical or super cosmic in any kind of advanced awareness today, because all forms of awareness make the world make sense now. So you're going to specialize in the hobby in some kind of old form of developed sensibility, which neotech seems to resonate with what you prefer.
Well, hobby doesn't sound like a very serious occupation for one serious about such things.
Okay, well, under electric conditions, you know, the hobby becomes your work and your work becomes your hobby. So what you mean is that your hobby has to have a serious tone to it. And I'm making it sound not so serious.
Yeah. Now, the thing about it is it seems to lack a sense of humor. Like, they send you this book which is basically black and white and you know, looks like a satanic Bible in a way. And has to do a great deal with personal power and, you know, sort of a sex manual at the same time. So,
So it seems to wake up it's the narcissism of the body. It's the narcissism of the body hoping to last forever. And that is the visual space Greek form of the body, bounded by a line on a bag of chemicals.
Oh, hi. My radio went off, so I lost your last explanation there.
I just said that the...
That's okay. Our theme music's come up anyway, Bob, so...
Oh, so you're putting me to sleep, caller. You're putting me to sleep.
Why?
Because you got so much restful slack talking about your hobby. It's penetrating me. I don't think I can go on anymore. You're just like a bed.
Albert Collins experiencing a little tongue lashing from one of the early albums he did. You don't have to call for my friend Lorne at Don's disc number 2, The Consolers.
In my conversation on the telephone.
Good night, Bob.
I didn't want this song.
I'll see you in 2 weeks.
But I made the mistake and I fell asleep at the wheel. I hope that caller didn't mind, but his hobby put me to sleep. And Mike is presenting our Tai Chi church hymn as we go back to work. The church of hobby is over, Bobby.
She told me everything is going along all right.
But when I asked her how she was feeling, the answer was still the same. I thank God that things are as well.
Consola's gospel group and a gospel song. Thank God things are as well as they are. Look out now, going out of Kitchener Waterloo. Jimmy Reed, you got me dizzy.
With an overwhelming majority.
Has it done?
CK Lane touching down where the meat is.
Malik.
Where is my baby?
Indeed, touching down in fine style live to the capital. You better believe it, it's the People's Choice Radio landing with Ryan Malik X on Downtown's phone frequency, 88.1 CKLM. Locking again this Saturday from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. when we get on the good foot. That's right, that's what I'm talking about. The RGE, the Rare Groove Experience, the London Groove, and of course the Name It and Claim It. The happening underground sound in town right here on Radio London every Saturday from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. Malik X says, tune in, over and out, whoosh.
Can I speak to Yolanda,
now,
please?
Hold on,
stand
please.
Straight
thank
and
you.
Call it attention, because we're so proud to sing our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner.
Hi, my president, George Butch, hoping soon to be your president. And here's my favorite song, the Bully Song, take one.
I like to kick someone weaker.
Panic Productions and CKLN are pleased to present, all the way from Greensboro, North Carolina, the Mad Dr. Eugene Chadbourne, in concert with Bobby Wiseman. Expand your musical universe with two evenings of electrified, psychedelic improv music, dragged through the cowpie-laden world of country and western bebop. The first show is Sunday, April 1st at the Rivoli, 334 Queen Street West. The second show is Monday, April 2nd at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West. All ages are welcome, and tickets are available at the doors for $7. $5 for students, seniors, and underemployed. Showtime is 8 p.m. both nights. Eugene Chadbourne and Bobby Wiseman at the Rivoli, Sunday, April 1st, and the Music Gallery, Monday, April 2nd. A Panic production and CKLN-FM presentation.
Oh, did they, the communists, a power of gathering member of the International Communist Conspiracy?
You are listening to the second broadcast of SIAM, the Society of Industrial Arts and Music. After having so many positive responses to our first sending, we decided to come back and give it to you again. Broken into two blocks, harsh noise and pop noise, our aim with this sending is to give you a taste of the many different sounds of industrial music. The first cut from this section comes from the now-defunct band Nine Firemen Nine. Cheval Bataille is from the first of this former band's two tapes, Tar. Next, a cut from Broom's catalog tape. The Dream of the Glassblowers from Vendrame Romeo's Ron Blumen tape comes up third.